Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to Development Hell. Today, we have our special guest, Grady Hendrix, and we're going to be talking about the never-made Kevin Williamson script, Halloween 7, The Revenge of Laurie Strode. So yeah, Grady, how would you introduce yourself?
I am a guy who writes books and movies sometimes, but mostly books. I wrote a horror story about a haunted IKEA, My Best Friend's Exorcism, which is sort of Beaches meets The Exorcist, a book called Paperbacks from Hell, which is a nonfiction history of the horror paperback boom of the 70s and 80s. And my last book was The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. And my new book that's coming out this summer is called The Final Girl Support Group, which is why we're talking about Halloween H2O.
Wow. Actually, you were talking about Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode. How dare you? But
well,
yes,
I
basically
know, but
the same thing.
Well, so, you know, it's funny, though. There's stuff in The Revenge of Laurie Strode that they put into H2O, and they do it terribly, which is really interesting.
Very bad.
We'll get to that.
So how familiar are you with Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode, outside of the outline I sent you?
Yeah, the outline you sent me, and I've read a synopsis of it before, like one or two online, but I've never read the screenplay. The only unproduced Halloween screenplay I've ever read is Dennis Etchison's Halloween from 1987, you know, before they did 4, when they were going to reboot the franchise. And they had Etchison, who was a really well-known horror short story writer mostly, and an editor, write a version. And it's... Well, my mom said, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. But that's never stopped me before. It's hot garbage.
Is it?
But it's the first...
Is this the one with the giant Michael Myers at the end?
Yes. I didn't hate it. But it's the first time I think Thorne gets mentioned in the franchise. I think it's where they started getting... Because it's like 87. So I imagine they either told him we want druids or he gave them druids and they ran with them.
Oh, is it because of like satanic panic of the time? Is that what we're
I don't know. You know, I mean, who knows what goes on in Mustafa Akkad's mind, right? Did he just read an article about druids and was like, we should have some of these?
Maybe he comes from the druids. You never know.
Well, he could be a druid.
He is a
druid. Could be the QAnon of druid conspiracy theories that the Halloween franchise is just an attempt to normalize druids. Ha ha, they failed. Everyone hates druids now because of Halloween.
Yeah, they're very embarrassing now because of Halloween. But yeah, that script is very wacky. There are so many unproduced Halloween scripts out there. Thank you, Reddit, for all of them, because there's just a shocking amount online. There's one called Halloween 3000, which I'm obsessed with.
Wait, which one's that?
So we're going to get to it a little later, but just for now, it follows a little boy named Jimmy Moyer, who murders two of his classmates and his mom, and an intern at Smith's Grove. And so basically this little Jimmy becomes the next Michael Myers. Then he breaks out of the asylum years later and kills a bunch of people. Very Friday the 13th Part 5 vibes.
Yeah.
So good.
It's funny though, like whenever these franchises try to give the dude a break, right? Like, they want to give Jason a break, or they want to give Michael Myers a break, and they have someone else pick up the mask. Never works. No. And I'm not sure, has that ever happened with the Halloween franchise, or it's just been almost about to happen? Like, Danielle Harris was going to be Michael at one point.
It's almost happened a couple of times in Halloween. Apparently, they were going to try to do it at a Halloween Resurrection sequel, where they were going to try to give it to the Josh Hartnett character. But no, I don't think it's ever happened.
Yeah, because Friday it happened once or twice, and then they gave up on it pretty fast.
Fans get pissed.
Like, which is weird, because what do we care who's behind the mask?
I don't care, but people, they care. Yeah. I mean, listen, Friday 5, it wasn't good, but it wasn't good because of the twist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But maybe people get those two things confused. Yeah, listen, we are precious with our horror icons, and I can respect that, because we don't have that much in this world. And the horror icons, you know, we need to hold them dear.
I also think when you get, you know, we have so few places to exercise choice and discernment in our lives.
Okay.
So, you know, I want Jason Voorhees, whose mother was, you know, Mrs. Voorhees, who lives at the bottom of Camp Crystal Lake, or, you know, at the lake. Like, you know, I don't want some image. I don't want Tommy Jarvis. I don't want someone else, you know?
Yes. And horror fans, we're so prickly. We will give you all of our money, but at the same time, like, you don't want to mess with us too hard. What's your personal relationship with the Halloween series for you?
Poor. My personal relationship with Halloween is poor.
Wow. Yeah. I'm surprised.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. So I wasn't allowed to see R-rated movies as a kid. And so what I would do is, after Cub Scout meetings, we would go over across the street from the church to this gas station where we buy snacks.
Oh, my God.
And I convinced the Scoutmaster that my parents let me buy magazines with my snack money. And I would buy Fangoria and would then read the movies about the movies and pretend I'd seen them. And actually, for years, I thought I had seen Friday the 13th Part 2. And like 3 years ago, I was like, oh, I'll rewatch this. And I was like, oh, I've seen this for the first time. I had lied for so long, I believed my lie.
Wow.
I've never been a huge, huge slasher fan. I like them, I appreciate them, but it's not my first go-to, you know? And when I went to, it was usually Nightmare or Friday the 13th. I had a lot of respect for the original Halloween. I think it's a really, really classic movie. It's not a movie I love. Mm-hmm. I saw Halloween 2 on TV a few times as a kid. And that movie I have a lot of affection for, but in all the wrong ways. Halloween 3 is the same way. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know, there's so many good things about it in theory. The John Carpenter music, although by the time you get to part 4, 5, 6, 7, you're like, I'm really sick of this theme.
Yeah.
And they rely on it like a crutch in a lot of these movies.
And it's like three notes for 10 movies.
Exactly. But like, you know, I appreciate the cinematography. There's so many things I appreciate about it, but I've never really loved it. You know what I mean? Like, which is weird, because it's also like the super serious franchise. Like, Jason seems to have some self-awareness. He likes to, you know, he likes to make his kills a little like fancy sometimes, maybe ironic. Nightmare on Elm Street, like, Freddy's like a showman. It gets very campy. Like, dour and humorless, I think, are like the operative words for Halloween. Yes. Like,
and that can make them boring.
Yeah. And I appreciate that they're super fast. They're super to the point usually. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about them is they are the family trauma ones, right? Like, like, no one knows why they're getting killed in Friday the 13th. No one's sure exactly after the first movie or two why Freddy's coming after them. But like, in Halloween, you either are Laurie Strode, you are related to Laurie Strode, or you're Laurie Strode adjacent.
Yeah, they really commit to it too in a way that we just don't see anymore with our franchises. Like, a commitment to the canon. To the point where, like, it made everything confusing. But I respect it now. I kind of wish that we would have a little bit more respect these days for, you know, the older installments of these franchises.
Well, it's funny, you know, I saw a screening about 5 years ago in 35 of the original Halloween. And, you know, it is amazing how bloodless that movie is when you watch it again. Like, there's like four kills in the whole thing, and they're in shadow. Like, they're not super graphic. It's really interesting to compare that to something like, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 4 or something that's just so over the top.
Disgusting. So I just rewatched that recently, and that cockroach death is just gross. I love it.
Yeah. And it's funny, I guess, you know, I guess with the first Halloween, the kills weren't set pieces. You know, the way they get later, I mean, they are set pieces, mm-hmm. but the kill itself, the gore, the deployment of it, I mean, I feel like that's something that the Friday the 13th franchise with Tom Savini really pioneered.
Absolutely. People relate them to porn a lot, where like you have these, yeah, you have like the money shots and then everything else is sort of just to get there in between.
Yeah, but I also feel like, you know, it's funny, I've seen that porn comparison, but mm-hmm. I feel like with these movies, the story is so important, even when the story gets ridiculous and stupid. I mean, Halloween 6, like, it's still really important. In a way, it's not important in porn. Like, yes. You don't have the story and you've just got faces of death. And like, let's face it, like, faces of death is not that interesting.
Yeah, I am only aware of the cover and I'll have to watch it one day. I was just doing an episode on the Hellraiser reboot that never happened. And there was talk about pitting Michael Myers against Pinhead at one point, and Clive Barker is the one on record saying that it didn't happen because the Akkads treat Michael Myers as though he's Hamlet. And I love that. I also love how shady Clive Barker is.
Yeah. Well, also, I like the idea of Michael Myers as Hamlet. You know, it's so great. Too.
It kind of makes sense. Like,
you watch the different incarnations of Michael Myers, and it's like you watch Halloween 4 where like the dude is almost indestructible. And then you watch H2O and like, it, you know, just a jock with a rock can really take him out. Like, yeah. He just gets nerfed and more powerful. And Dennis Etchison's writing the script. He can grow to 12 feet tall. Like, he's very fluid.
Mm-hmm. Malleable. It's not my favorite of the franchises either. And I think, yes, I think when you said the sense of humor isn't really there. And I think for some people, that's why it's the go-to franchise. But yeah, for me, it's the reason why it can get a little boring sometimes.
There's something a little, even when the movies are goofy, there's something a little intense about Halloween, because it is literally a dude relentlessly stalking a woman and trying to murder her, the same woman, over and over again. And there's something very like gross about that. Like, there's something mm-hmm. a little too intense about it. That I feel like, you know, in Friday the 13th, like, you're like, oh, that person, that's sad. Oh, that's funny. And this, it's always like, this woman is living out a nightmare that is very common in real life. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, summer camp being murdered was not a realistic concern. Having a leech go up my nose and eat my brain over the course of the next 3 weeks was a realistic concern. But being stalked and murdered was not. But for like women, having a dude who comes after you again and again, trying to kill you or hurt you, mm-hmm. is real. And so there's a personal, emotionally traumatic, squeaky element to Halloween that I think makes it hard to take in big doses, which is why I appreciate the Thorne trilogy a little more, because it gets away from that some.
So you do appreciate the Thorne trilogy. I have a hard time with it personally. It just...
Well, I like 4. 4 is a lot of fun.
4 is fun for sure.
5 is just a slasher. It's just generic. You know what I mean? Just add water, government issue, white label, black mm-hmm. writing, mm-hmm. slasher.
Except for the element of the man in black, which is not good, but really out of the box.
Yeah.
Bizarre. And they try to solve it in a couple of these unmade scripts. Like, there was a 7th direct-to-video iteration of this movie that didn't happen, where they really try to tackle the man in black.
Well, yeah, and then 6 is just an ungodly mess, but it's always kind of fun to like squint at and be like, what were they doing here? What version of the movie was this? Like, where did this piece come from?
It's wild. Also, young Paul Rudd. That's...
Yes, that's, I know. There's a lot to be said for young Paul Rudd.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's still with us today, young Paul Rudd.
I feel like he'll be with us forever. As long as there's baby's blood to be sucked, Paul
that's
Rudd
gotta
will be young.
That's got to be it, right? It's, yeah, it's... QAnon was right. Paul Rudd is killing babies. I'm going to cut that out.
You know, he's so charming, I'm okay with that.
Do you have any, like, underrated Final Girls that you want to campaign for? Like, are there any Final Girls that don't get talked about enough?
I gotta say, there's two that come to mind right away, and one I don't think is underrated, but I feel like she should get more gold stars on the calendar. I'm not sure, but you know, Alice Hardy, because, you know, I saw the beginning of Friday 2 was the one I read about in Fangoria and like described to people, and then I think I saw it, they're just the opening of it years later on cable. And that's always struck me as this really traumatic thing, that here's this woman who survives all this hideous stuff, has to decapitate someone. I mean, that can't feel good. What? And then, like, she's just like, okay, well, I'll eventually get over it. I'm going to live in this sad house and, you know, eventually just feel better. And, like, gets murdered, like, straight up cold-blooded murdered right at the beginning. And I'm always like, that is so mean. It's like, you know, it's a little bit like the thing at the end of H2O, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, which I also think is a tremendously mean-spirited thing to do to a character or an actor. So I really wish Alice Hardy little more props for her. I mean, I don't know. Do you have one?
You finish up and then we'll go back.
Okay. The other one I was going to say is, and this is a bit of a stretch, but I've always thought that, you know, Dracula is the book, the Bram Stoker book, is sort of the first time we get that kind of predatory dude, monster, stalker figure that will become so huge later in 20th century literature. And that would make Mina Harker kind of the first final girl. Like, and what's interesting in that book is that Mina Harker, you know, sees all this hideous stuff like happen, and everything that's supposed to make her weaker or destroy her just makes her pissed off and stronger. Like, Dracula kills her best friend, that just makes her angry. Dracula bites her, then she just like boomerangs out on him and uses like her connection with Dracula to like track him down to kill him. Like, everything he does to fuck her up, she uses like turns into a weapon. Yeah. And I've always thought that was kind of like a really proto final girl is Mina Harker.
Okay, so obviously my turn. Hello. Final girls. Okay. I thought you were going to say Alice from Nightmare, and I was really excited, and then you didn't. So sorry. I love Alice from, you know, these series sometimes have like a trilogy in the center, as we were talking about with Thorne.
Yeah.
The trilogy in the center of Nightmare, I love. And the Alice that comes in part four, I just like, I have a really soft spot for her. She's so mousy, but I don't know. I like her.
I can see that. And also 4, 5, 6 are really the forgotten Nightmare movies. Like 1, 2, 3, everyone remembers 3, 7. Mm-hmm. It gets all meta, but that middle trilogy just, you know.
Yeah. It's not respected as much as it should be. 5 needs more love because it's very watchable. It's very entertaining.
Yeah.
And disgusting.
I haven't seen 6 in so long. I mean,
oh,
I don't remember.
Don't. It's truly not. Like, I will take a long journey to make myself like these movies, and that one, it's hard. Like, I enjoy the remake. I'll be like, okay, I'll watch the... I'm not bored watching the remake.
Right.
But 5, but 6, yeah. Although, Roseanne, interesting cameo.
Oh my god, I forgot. Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Roseanne, Tom Arnold, Alice Cooper. Yeah, maybe you should watch it. What am I saying? They like they name drop Twin Peaks a number of times. It's very strange.
Really? God, I'm
gonna
have to rewatch it.
I reached out to Rachel Talele, and obviously she doesn't know who I am, so she did not get back to me. But I'd love to talk to her at some point. The director of it.
Yeah.
And my last one is did you watch, please God, you're the only person that maybe would have watched this, the early 90s reboot of Dark Shadows?
No.
Oh, it's literally, well, how do you have a relationship with Dark Shadows?
I don't really. You know, like, my grandmother, who was big on soaps around a little Dark Shadows-y times, she just wouldn't watch it. It was too creepy for her. So, okay. No, I never, like, absorbed it at the right age.
Okay, well, if you ever get around to it, they made a bizarre reboot in the early 90s that only lasted a season. And I am extremely obsessed with it, and I really recommend it. And there's a very interesting female lead in that. So I think we're going to move on towards maybe talking a little bit about Final Girl Support Group, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so what can you tell us about Final Girl Support Group at this moment in time?
I can tell you everything. I could read it to you if I
no
wanted.
No way.
But basically... essentially, the conceit of the book is that that these franchises are based on real crimes, and then they go on to do their own thing. But these final girls from these original incidents, they're still alive. And it's 20 years later, because the book takes place in 2010. It was originally a book that took place in contemporary, but then COVID happened. And I was like, I just got to bump this back, you know, let's just take it back before this. So
smart.
I put it in 2010. And so these women are all sort of, you know, they're middle-aged, and they've all sort of like, you know, dealt with what happened to them in different ways. Some are substance abusers, some are in denial about it, some have gone full survivalist, But the one constant in their life is that for 16 years, they've been going to the same support group. And then someone starts to kill them one by one. And the most paranoid member of the support group tries to like set out to prove that this is, you know, that they're all in danger and no one believes her. And so that's the basic concept of the book. And the book really, there's sort of two places it came from. And one is that scene with Alice Hardy at the beginning of Friday 2, where I'm like, this isn't good. Like, you should be nicer to this lady. And the other is when I was a kid and I saw, I was at a friend's house spending the night and his mom took us to see Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. And Heather Langenkamp appears as the final girl from Nightmare 1 as a therapist for the kids in Nightmare 3. And I'm like, holy cow. I'm like, that is such a great idea. Like, characters from one horror movie, helping out characters from another horror movie. Like, hey, I've got a little experience with this. And those just sort of germinated in my head. And I wrote a first draft of this book in 2014. Mm-hmm. And I tried to sell it to my publisher, I think in 2016. And literally they sent me back the Publisher's Weekly announcement for Riley Sager's Final Girl book. And they're like, fuck off. We're not interested in your book. And I'm like, God damn it. So this book just sat there and I rewrote it a few times over the years, but I was like, no one's going to care. And then my manager who does all my movie stuff was like, do you have anything sitting in the drawer? And I gave him this and he's like, dude, you've got to work on this. There's something here. And so I rewrote it a bunch more and then sold it. So this is a book that I've sort of lived with for a really long time, longer than I've ever lived with another book, like 7 years. It winds up being a lot about sort of like how, you know, there comes that moment if you're a big fan of horror, you ask yourself that question, like, I've spent a lot of my life watching people get murdered for like fun. Like, what does that mean? Like, what does that say? Not in a boring way, but just sort of like, what am I? You are what you eat. So what am I eating?
Yeah.
Just sort of like figure out all that stuff for myself, you know? Mm-hmm. And then,
well, you know, it's arguable that it's healthy, you know? Would you think at the end of the day it would be healthy over it being maybe not so good for you, ingesting all of this carnage?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, for me, what I realize, and like, it's different for everyone, right? Like, some people are in it for the special effects. Some people, like, they're really into it because they love makeup and they love monsters and all that. And they're all legit reasons. But I realize that for me, just because the way I came to horror movies was so weird because I couldn't see them. I could mostly just read about them. So I had a very different image in my head of what they were than what they were before I saw them. Mm-hmm. For me, I realized that, like, oh, what's always been important to me in these movies is that they're about people who get the worst thing that can possibly happen to them, happens to them. And then it happens to them often again and again and again. And they keep on trucking. And it's one of the reasons I'm always surprised I don't resonate. The Halloween franchise doesn't resonate more with me because that's really what that franchise is about, is that Laurie Strode takes a beating and keeps on going. And so I realize that for me, these movies are really about, you know, people surviving the worst possible shit. And that I really am not a huge fan of bleak, dark endings. You know, like, I really like to see people survive and kind
I've noticed.
You know, yeah, have a chance at happiness. Like, yeah. I don't know.
And that's nice. That's only fair after what you do to them for all those pages.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, like, I feel like if I've hit an unhappy ending, it's like, I just haven't written for long enough. Like, I'm not there yet. I got to keep going.
I love that. I love something scary with an okay ending because I don't want to feel like crap. So I've noticed that your work, from what I've read, ranges from very fun and nostalgic to very serious and very scary. And I'm wondering where the tone is going to land with this new book.
Yeah, well, I was actually really worried about this book because it's a darker, kind of angrier book. Like, I did a book called We Sold Our Souls that's very in this tone. Sort of a darker, angrier, more a little bit bleaker, but I gave it to some friends to read, sort of, and like, people who won't lie to me, like other writers and stuff, and they all really liked it. And I was like, okay, phew, thank God. Like,
good sign.
So I think it winds up in an okay place, but like, you know, it is about monstrous people killing women. If that's a, you know, if that's traumatic for you or triggers something for you, don't read it. Like, it's also like, I don't know. One of the things I've always been a little bummed about is that so many Final Girl projects, like Scream Queens and the Final Girls movie and stuff like that, they're fun. Like, I had a good time with them, but they treat Final Girls a little campy, and they do this kind of Mean Girls thing, which I feel like is a tone a lot for female characters, of like everyone's just sort of bitchy and tearing each other down. And I was like, well, what happens if we take these women seriously? Like, what happens if you actually like really get rid of sort of the ironic, we know the genre kind of thing, and are like, this happened. That's horrible. Someone dressed as Santa Claus tried to kill you. That is really upsetting in a lot of ways. Christmas is ruined.
Yeah, forever.
Yeah.
Well, that gets me to wondering. I believe that you write women quite well, and that doesn't mean you do. It's just how I think. Why do you think that could be? Like, why do you think you have the ability to write women as real people or with a little bit of empathy, maybe better than other male authors? And what can other male authors maybe do to sort of tighten the way they write women characters?
I don't know. Like, I'm really bad at giving advice, but I, you know, people have said this before, and I feel like I just treat them like people, you know, like it's just, they're just people. I mean, and one of the things that really helps me, and one of the reasons I think I write about women so often, and it's not like a conscious choice, it's just sort of like a lot of times when you're like writing a book or coming up with an idea for a book, at least for me, it's like a, it's like one of those stupid puzzle keys you get in something like National Treasure, where you have to like turn this ring of this cylinder to this like symbol and this one and that symbol, and eventually it like clicks and then it unfolds. It's like the the box in Hellraiser. Oh my god, I forgot.
The Lehmann configuration.
The Lehmann configuration, exactly. You gotta get all the pieces and then it clicks and then it opens and, you know, chains with hooks on them shoot out and embed themselves in your face. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I just sort of cycle through junk. What if the characters that got it, okay, this, you know, and it's like, what if it's winter, what if it's summer, what if it's fall, okay, fall. And so it often winds up being women, because I don't write dudes well because they're too close to me. I like to have a distance between myself and the characters, like, because otherwise I just feel like I'm writing about myself and whatever I put down there reflects me, so they have to be like really handsome and charming and capable. But if I have a distance on them, I can kind of look at them a little more objectively and see them as a person and not just some reflection of my personality. And so making them a different gender than me helps with that a lot.
I feel like that's literally the opposite of how a lot of writers work. I feel like a lot of people can't write the opposite gender because they can't relate to it.
So I really like the Jack Reacher books. Like, they're like my comfort popcorn thing.
Yeah.
And you read early interviews with Lee Child, and he's like, oh, Jack Reacher, he's this guy, you know, God, he sells everything with violence. And he really talks about him like a separate person. And then later in his career, like 30 books later, Lee Child's like, yeah, I got in a fist fight with a dude on the street and I headbutted him. And he almost is like wearing the Jack Reacher persona. And you're like, oh, I get it. You've done so many, you're such a showman.
Sorry.
A little bit. Yeah. Like you just sort of like, you've told these stories so many times that you've realized that people want you to be Jack Reacher. So now you're like wearing him. You know what I mean? Like, but when it started, he wrote someone who was the opposite of him. So it's just like, you know, I think it's, you're right that a lot of people, like, they either realize the audience wants them to be like their character, or they make themselves into their character.
I did not realize that this new book is going to be about adult women, because so often when we hear about Final Girls, they're often, or almost all the time, teens. And I'm very excited, just because not long ago I finished your book, The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. I get so scared when I have to say that title. And I just love how you write like mature women. And I love to read about mature women. They're just, you know, they're my favorite demo out there. So,
well, it's funny, when I originally was going to write Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires, or I get it wrong all the time, I'm like, the Southern Vampires Guide to Clubbing Steaks. And I was talking to my editor and I was like, yeah, I really want to write this book. And I told him about it, and he's like, yeah, cool. So I started writing. I was about 6 weeks in, and he's like, he gives me a call and he's like, listen, you can keep writing the book, but I was talking to sales and marketing, and that's sort of a sentence you never want to hear as a writer, because nothing that comes after that and is going to be in your favor. And he's like, and they just, you know, A, vampires, they just, who wants to read vampire stuff? And B, they just are like, we can't sell a book about middle-aged women. We just don't know how to do that. Okay. And I was like, on the one hand, it really threw me, because I'm like, they were like, you know, and I was like, but that's what the whole book's about, how these women get dismissed and they're not dismissible. But then I realized, you know, well, yeah, like Quirk, my publisher at the time, like, that wasn't their demographic. You know, their readership was very young, and it was very, you know, and I got it. Like, publishers are good at selling certain kinds of books, and this wasn't a book they knew how to sell at that point. Now, a couple of years later, I wrote the book, they sold it, and they did a great job with it. But at the time, they had real doubts, and I get it, you know, and I think people really worry about, you know, well, we sell action adventure. How do we sell this kind of book? We sell to a young readership. How do we sell to one? And it is a very weird thing, because at the end of the day, the audience of readers out there is teeny tiny. Like, it's not a big pool of people, but it's very segmented. You know, romance readers don't read Westerns in general, or that's the publishing wisdom, you know. YA readers don't read adult fiction. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's sort of how the publishing thinking mentality of it. These people read this and not that. It's very odd.
Well, with SEO, you'd think they would know by now.
Yeah, I know, right?
I only read horror. I very rarely will reach out of horror, so maybe I buy it.
Really? That's so weird. But do you only watch horror movies, or do you watch other things as well?
You know what? I mostly only watch horror movies.
I admire your devotion.
I'm sorry. It's just where I'm at.
No, it's nothing to apologize for. I'm like, because when I do a book, I try to do, instead of an author event, I try to do like a show, like about the book. So like when I did Southern Book Club, I had a big thing that wound up not happening because there was a pandemic, about like the history of vampires and where they come from and how they got so sexy. And so for this, I'm doing a thing about murder books, like, you know, this sort of like genre of fiction and movies that is about people killing people. And so all I'm doing right now is reading slasher books, basically, because there was a huge glut of them in the 90s. And like, I'm like, can I please just read a comedy? Can I please read like anything, romance, anything but this?
Romance. But you have enough of the slashers. I read a recent YA slasher book that I didn't hate. Clown in a Cornfield. Does this sound familiar to you?
Oh, Adam Cesar's.
I read it over Halloween and it was very fun.
No, it's super fun. Yeah. And he's a really good guy as well, which is always nice.
Oh, wow. Are you like, what's Stephen King's band, where the Rock Bottom Remainders?
Oh, yeah.
Are you all just in a band together?
No, but I've had dinner with Adam before. I think he lives in Philly. And I had dinner down here with him and some other people. So it's really nice to see like that book doing really well.
So Kevin Williamson, I'm a fan. I don't know what your relationship with him is. Do you guys lunch?
No, don't know him. Oh. I once did some work on a possible reboot of The Faculty, but it didn't really go very far. And that was cool. No, it was fine. It was really, really fun to work on, but it was like...
No, as a fan, that's horrible. I'm a huge Faculty head, so that's too
bad. Know, it's really fun, and like, you know, but the impression I got, though, and I didn't interact with him at all. I was just dealing with his producer, who's sort of like talking for him and taking things back and forth, but is that he's really definite about what he wants, even when he doesn't know what he wants. Do you know what I mean? He's very much like, Relatable. No, that's not it. And that's actually a really rare skill I've discovered with filmmaking. Like, everyone wants to say yes because everyone wants a movie greenlit, because then that makes people money, and a greenlit movie is better than a not greenlit movie. And he seems to be someone who has no fear about being like, nope, we'll just say no on this and table it for a few years and maybe come back to it when it's right.
Hey, when you're Kevin Williamson, you have the ability to do that.
Yeah, so, and it's impressive though. Yeah.
What's your relationship with the Scream series?
You know, so I really love Scream 1 and 2, and I actually just rewatched Scream during 2020, actually, and I was blown away by just how good it is. It's like
so good.
It's so good. And it's like seeing Friday 2, and you're like, this isn't going to be as good as I remember it. And then you're like, oh my God, this is such a well-done movie. Yeah,
Friday 2 is incredible, but
it really is. But it's also, I got to say, it's got a low bar to clear because, you know, Sean Cunningham is not a great director.
No.
So it's he's basically
a porno director.
Yeah. And so it's like you look at Friday 1 and 2 back to back and you're like, oh, this movie has shots. This movie has pace. And Scream is just such a well put together movie. I mean, it is like rock solid. Scream 2, I really like. I mean, that set piece with the cop car and crawling through the windshield is so good.
People don't talk about that enough. That's a great moment.
Yeah, it's really great. And like, and then 3, I really feel pretty poorly about. And Yeah, I feel like 3 just got so self-aware and so kind of campy. I was like, because the nice thing about 1 is that beginning is so meta. Yes. And then when Drew Barrymore gets stabbed, that is freaking brutal. And you're like, oh, this is going to combine this sort of snarkiness with like the actual horribleness of these murders. Mm-hmm. And 2 does that in some way, which I really appreciate. So I didn't, I never saw 4 and I probably should.
Oh, I recommend it.
You but I'm definitely I'm, do I'm it. Excited to see the next one whenever that comes out. 2050.
Yeah. Yeah. 2025. Who knows? But Kevin Williamson was on the set. So that's cute. Yeah. I'm excited for that one. 2. I definitely recommend 4. Something about 2 has never really connected with me. And I think it's because I went to theater school and the whole Greek theater part of it, I just find so embarrassing.
Yeah, it really is. But it's like, it's funny though, whenever movies show theater or video games or publishing, they just get it so embarrassingly wrong. It's ridiculous.
Like, this is what you people do. All right, so moving on, I just want to like touch base again on some of these other canceled Halloween sequels because I'm obsessed with them. We talked a little bit about Halloween 3000, so I'm going to skip it. There was a MichaelMyers.com concept at one point, which like, how could they have not made that? That sounds so good.
I know.
Turned out to be Halloween Resurrection. Also a good title, but not as good. There was a movie going to be called Halloween 666. The Origin of Michael Myers, which I think is the best title they could have ever come up with.
I also, go ahead. I was going to say, I also don't know why the 6th installment out of every franchise isn't 666.
I know that it's wasted opportunity every time. But, you know, maybe Conjuring 666, because that would work, because religious horror.
Well, is it Children of the Corn
3
or 4? Its original title was going to be Field of Screams, which is like the best title. And then they were like worried about getting sued. So they changed it to something like, you know, Field of Terror. Field of Screams.
Field of Screams is hilarious. First of all, that's just a good title in general. Yeah. There is no more boring film of all time than Field of Dreams. So rip it. It's funny you bring that franchise up because I'm almost positive that is the franchise that did commit to calling the 6th movie 666.
Yeah, you're right. It is.
So good for that movie. There was going to be an original 7th Halloween movie called Halloween 7, Two Faces of Evil. This was going to be like the first direct-to-video sequel in the franchise, kind of like Hellraiser Inferno. And it was going to take place at a prep school. And there's going to be sort of like a Silence of the Lambs copycat killer element in it. But when Jamie Lee Curtis got involved, of course, it went big budget and that script was scrapped. Maybe for the best. I love a direct-to-video crappy sequel. Like when it really just commits to being its worst quality self and it's like not pretending. Yeah.
What year was that going to be roughly? Do you know?
Same, 1997, 1998. 97?
Yeah, that late 90s direct-to-video kind of serial killer thriller genre.
So
like,
good.
It is a sweet spot.
Oh, I love it. I am not precious with Hellraiser, which is, I think, why I can get so into those crappy sequels. But they made one called Hell World. I think it's number 8. And it's, like, internet-themed with, like, ravers doing, like, an internet rave. I really recommend it. Also, Henry Cavill is in it for some reason.
Oh, nice.
They were going to make a Halloween H2K, Evil Never Dies, which I'm so sad they didn't do. Obviously, direct sequel to Halloween H2O. On All That Matters is that it was going to be Y2K taking place.
Oh, and that'd be beautiful.
H2K, first of all, better title than H2O, which I will never get over it being the worst title of all time.
It really is. It's poor, I think, in being generous.
I think about it all the time, about like, how did that happen? What marketing person made that happen? And they succeeded because a big hit. But
well, I'm sure their comp was like, people are like, I don't know. And they're like, listen, guys, the most popular drink on the planet.
It's good point. Everybody's house. Like
80% of their body is made up of it.
We relate to it, you know, it's in our DNA.
Exactly.
And blood is thicker than water, so that also doesn't make any sense. And it's just so sad because Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode, truly the best title of all time. So it's like, you could have had the best title and you're going with the worst. I'm very sad.
Although, you know, the funny thing with that title, Revenge of Laurie Strode, like, to me, great title. In a marketing meeting, I'm like, you're going to be like, who the hell knows who Laurie Strode is?
That's you know? True. A handful of very passionate fans. That's it. Yeah, Halloween H2O. And it, well, I don't know how to get into this, but clearly this movie was made because of Scream. Like, everything about this movie is extremely post-Scream. From the writer to the music to the tone. And you just know that the people behind, like, Jamie Lee Curtis and friends, you know, they saw the success of Scream and they're like, well, like, let's get back at it.
And they weren't wrong. I mean, you know, we're betting on talent. They were like, we bet Kevin Williamson can do this again.
Yeah, and he definitely
it's also could. There's also something with movies from this era, especially horror movies, where everything tries to look like 90210. Like, you know, everything looks like a CW or a Fox show, from the casting to the clothes to that ridiculous, when they have the romantic dinner and, like, it is a 90210 level amount of candles in that room. It's like, if they started lighting those candles at noon, they still would be doing it at noon the next day.
What teenager did this? And no teenagers did this.
No, exactly. And that was before they had those electric flicker candle bulbs that look good. So some poor art.
Do they look good though? Oh, you mean on film? Yes.
Oh, on film. Yeah. So like some poor art department person had to sit there and light all those freaking candles and keep them lit.
And make sure they were burning at the same rate. Ugh. Yeah. Poor PAs. Every time I see like, you know, there's like a storm on TV and branches are hitting the window, I'm like, the poor PA.
Also, I have to say, go ahead.
I was wondering if you've ever been a PA yourself.
I have. Me too. Several times. And I was an extra a lot too.
Oh, no. They don't treat those well.
It's funny. I'm actually an extra in Scream 2.
Shut up.
Yeah. In the opening theater scene.
Are you Sarah Michelle Gellar?
I'm wearing one of the masks. And my wife was doing extra work at the time. We were living in LA. And she's the woman who turns around and shushes Jada Pinkett Smith. And I'm like, my wife captured on film forever, a white woman silencing a black woman.
Oh, no.
Really problematic. Well
and
done.
Truly silenced her.
Yeah.
Like, she's dead. Good opening scene, actually.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. And it's also one of those things that's like, it's something that Scream does really well. That opening scene starts out as fun and meta, and look at Tori Spelling playing Drew Barrymore, and it gets pretty brutal by the time Jada Pinkett's getting, like, gutted.
Yeah, it's sad. And then that score comes in, and you're like, somebody help her! They can't. It's too late.
And if I remember correctly, I don't think we were all in the scene of her up on stage. I think they filmed that without all of us in there.
That's too bad. You know,
because I don't remember seeing that
performance. Yeah. That would have been cool. Wow, that's really iconic. Way to bury the lead on being in Scream 2 while we were talking about Scream 2.
I'm also in Dennis the Menace 2.
Yeah, still. Dennis the Menace 2. Okay, why not? So finally, we're like, getting to Halloween H2O, Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode. I appreciate your patience. First experience with Halloween H2O. What was that for you?
First experience was watching it like 3 weeks ago because we were going to do this podcast. And like, I knew the movie. Yeah, I know. I knew the movie. And I even think I might have gone to see it when it came out and wound up seeing something else. And I saw it. And I kind of love it, but I also hate it in equal measure.
Oh, no. Yeah, so, I get that. I do. I swear to God, I do get that. It's a lot of things happening at once, but there's something about it that's so satisfying, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think it's just Jamie Lee Curtis.
It's Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean, it's also like, it's such a tight movie. Like, once it gets rolling, like, I was looking at the running time and I'm like, it ends at like 85 minutes.
Yep. I was like, oh, it's over.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate
it. It's fast and to the point. It knows what you're there for. Yeah. And the other thing I thought was really, really, I mean, we can go on and on about Jamie Lee Curtis and we should, but one of the things that really irritated me about this movie, besides Josh Hartnett, is there is a bad jump scare like every 4 minutes on the dot, just about. Also, you know, one thing that has aged weirdly poorly is the white guidance counselor accidentally shooting LL Cool J. And you're like, and it's a great moment in the movie.
I didn't think about that.
You're just like, oh, you dumbass. And then you're like, oh, you super dumbass. And the thing that saves that moment is Jamie Lee Curtis's acting, because she's genuinely acting sad that this has happened.
Because she likes him. And also something that saves the moment is that he dies right after.
Exactly.
Immediately after. And gross.
Like, well, then LL right Cool J survives.
I know, which was like, how many times were you shot?
Yeah, and also I love that he's got a bandage around his head, which is literally not a place that's been injured at any point in the movie.
I was watching him act, and I was like, he's good at acting. He's got, like, really good impulses. What? And then it turns out I was unaware that he had been on a show before. Like, he had been on, like, 5 seasons of a TV show before that.
Yeah. Well, and also, just to talk about Jamie Lee Curtis for a minute.
Please.
Low point in this movie for Jamie Lee Curtis is the drinking problem. That is the worst, so hokiest, corniest drinking problem. And, you know, it's one of those things that's like, I just think it's just like, oh, yeah. And when the guidance counselor comes over and he's like, I think I need that drink. And she just pulls a bottle of vodka out and they drink from the bottle. Like, that's normal.
She's supposed to be a guidance counselor.
I know. She's so good in this movie. And every time her drinking problem comes up, I rolled my eyes so hard. I'm surprised they're still in my skull.
Okay, I love that you brought that up, because in the original script, The Revenge of Laurie Strode, they deal with the drinking disorder way better and way more nuanced. And she has, like, a really good monologue about how, like, she knows that she's suffering, but similar to your upcoming novel, like, when you've experienced the trauma she's gone through, like, you're just trying to make it until tomorrow. So, yeah, I agree with you. It's hokey as pokey in the film. But in the original script, or the original treatment, they really dealt with it well. It's like how she self-soothes post-extreme trauma. But they really let it drop in H2O.
And, you know, and I'm gonna lay that one at two sources, which I think, like, listen, if someone in Hollywood knows about addiction, it's Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean, she's very publicly wrestled with a painkiller addiction and talked about it at great length. But Steve Miner is not the most sensitive of directors of actors, I would suggest. And I also, Kevin Williamson, weirdly enough, has always had a weird relationship with drugs and alcohol in movies. He always sort of glosses it over or treats it like a joke. And I get it. You know what I mean? It's a fun shorthand way to indicate character. It's, you can play it for laughs. And I think his movies often move really fast and play stuff for laughs. But, like, look at the addiction stuff or the drug stuff in The Faculty. You know,
I don't remember. Can you help me?
Well, so Josh Hartnett, again, makes, like, basically what seems to be some kind of, like, speed for the other kids at school. Mm-hmm. And the drug is what turns out to be the one thing that can kill the aliens. So the kids have to do the drug to prove they're not an alien. It is really fun. It is a device I really wish I had thought of first. Mm-hmm. But it's not a particularly insightful look at drugs.
No, it's peer pressure almost. Like, what's the metaphor?
Yeah, and so I feel like sitting with addiction might have been something Kevin Williamson just wasn't that interested in, you know, for this movie. So it's interesting you say the original script really goes deep on it.
Way better. But also, like, reading the original treatment, Kevin Williamson is not the most sensitive of writers. Like, the way he describes women is, like, almost like a straight man. Like, very appearance based. It was not always the most sensitive of guys when it comes to writing. Yeah.
No, and I was gonna say another thing in this. Well, no, let's go on, because I could talk about Jamie Lee Curtis all day, and we'll probably.
I wish
come back
that we
to
would.
A few times. I know.
And I can always edit. So
I do want to say there is a moment in this movie that to me symbolizes the best and the worst of Halloween H2O. And that is that amazing moment, because it comes way earlier than you think it's going to come, when Jamie Lee Curtis is walking to her car and Michael Myers just starts walking up to her. And we've had so many fake out jump scares of her thinking she sees Michael that we know it's Michael, but she immediately does, I'm going to close my eyes and he'll be gone. And it is some of the best acting she's done in her career. It is a great, great, great moment that is completely undermined because you're like, oh my God, he's right there. And it's completely undermined because it cuts to a bad jump scare where the guidance counselor walks up. Hey, what's going on? What you thinking about? Right there. The highs of this movie and the lows side by side.
Mm-hmm. AKA Jamie Lee and that random guy. Best part, worst part. Yeah, I hear you on that one. And it happens again and it is real? I don't remember. So in the original, the trip to Yosemite, they say Yosemite so many times in this film.
Oh my God.
It's really funny. And there's a new Lana Del Rey song called Yosemite. So it's like been on my brain. I recommend it. It's very good.
Why are they so excited? What are they going to do in Yosemite?
They're going to bang. They're going to bang the Yos.
In one of our great national parks? That's disgusting.
I know. A shame. But yeah, in the original treatment, it was going to be a Halloween dance. They were not going to Yosemite. And all the kids were still at the school. So Michael kind of like breaks in and locks them all in. Like he messes up the gate. And, like, I guess he's, like, gonna kill everyone? I don't know. It doesn't really make as much sense. I was thinking that maybe a better or scarier premise would be if the kids went to Yosemite and Michael followed. Because it would be, like, you know, a little more, like, woodsy, creepy environment. And then Jamie Lee Curtis could show up with an axe and save the day. But
exactly. Or, I mean, there is a version of this where those kids go off to Yosemite where Jason just decapitates them one by one while they're fighting Michael Myers back at the school.
Oh my God, it's Michael versus Jason, finally. My best friend Jules cannot figure out which one's which, and as a horror fan, it's like very contentious. Like, she really tries, and every time it's the same person to her. And you know what, if you think about it really hard, they are the same.
They're very similar. The same. They both wear masks. They both wear jumpsuits.
White masks. The contouring on Michael in this movie, I forgot about. This is not the best he's ever looked. He kind of has the RuPaul contour.
Yeah, and I gotta say, like, it's also, he looks a little weaselly and undernourished in this movie.
He's hungry, yeah.
Yeah, and in some of those shots of his mask, because I know they switch masks during production, but, like, the eyes go down on the outside to give them kind of puppy dog eyes. It's just,
It's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think fans are not, they're not into how Michael looks in this movie. And it's truly not his best look. Halloween 6, he looks pretty scary.
Oh, he looks great in 6. He looks big and,
Because I think they managed to get the mold for the first mask in 6. I could just be making this up. But 4 and 5 are hilarious. Like, truly bad. They just, like,
I can't remember.
Did not even try.
If it's 4 or 5 where his hair literally just looks like they put glue on the top of a mask and rolled it around a barbershop floor.
Yeah.
It's just clumps.
It's 5. Yeah. And I think at one point in 5, he had blonde hair for a shot.
And yes, they didn't take absolutely. It out of the movie, yeah.
Which is very funny. I love, why not?
And speaking of hair, by the way, I just want to say that you can totally tell that Josh Hartnett and Jamie Lee Curtis are mother and son in this because they have the exact same haircut.
It is. Yes. Yeah. Also, in the original Revenge of Laurie Strode, he ends up getting decapitated with the blade of a helicopter, which is crazy. Mm. There's a lot of action and explosions. At one point, he is riding on top of a moving school bus.
Well, you know, it's funny. At the end of this, when she's doing, like, she's carring up on him, I was like, well, this is just the end of Halloween 4. Like, Michael should be used to clinging to a moving vehicle by now. Like, he's getting good at this.
Yeah, totally.
He does it when he escapes from the asylum in 1. Like, clinging to a moving vehicle is his thing, and he always flops at it.
Yeah, so when it comes to the differences between the two, I think we have it basically covered, which leads me to our very special segment where I have recorded some radio theater for you. And I was wondering if you would want to listen to it with me and then we could talk about it afterwards.
Can I say no? Oh, actually, can we come back to something really
quick? Yeah, please, God, yes.
Okay, I was just going to say, so talking about headcanon stuff, like the kids going to Yosemite and getting killed, I really, really, and there is no way to avoid this once you think it, I really imagine, and I think it's true. In my head, it's true that Janet Leigh is playing Lila Crane, the basically her sister in Psycho, who was played by Vera Miles, because she says to Jamie Lee Curtis at one point, she's like, bad things happen to people. You know, bad things, we've all had bad things happen to us before. And I'm like, oh my God, that's Marion Crane's sister who survived Norman Bates, and it's 40 years later or whatever, and she works at this school now.
Can you imagine if they put that much thought into this? You never know. Yeah, I'm always so excited for that cameo. Whenever that's happening, I'm just like, that's so brilliant. Just because, like, these are just so many layers at hand here. The two original final girls sort of interacting, and their mom and daughter in real life. It blows my mind.
I know, it's so weird. Okay, so no, I am into this radio theater thing.
Yes. So I have to give you a little bit of, like, a preface to it, which is, so this is the scene in Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode, that connects all of the prior movies together, including the Jamie stuff, the little sister stuff. And so it does so by having, her name's Carrie, but Laurie Strode is teaching a class, and a young girl does a book report on Laurie Strode and Michael Myers. And so that is the setup for the scene. So what we're going to do is, whenever you're ready, we're going to have a countdown and we're going to listen to it at the same time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play it over the recording for the audience in real life. But you and I are going to sort of just listen to it on our own right now. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yep.
So I'm going to count us down whenever you're ready so we can, like, have it all lined up.
I'm really, like, I'm ready. Like, oh, I don't know much more ready I can be.
I play Jamie Lee Curtis, so be very excited. But I did get casting for someone else because we can't do everything. Okay, so when you're ready, I'm going to count us down, okay?
All right, let's do it.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
Interior classroom, later that day. Students file into the class, sit in their assigned seats. Carrie stands behind a desk at the head of the class. The bell rings.
Good morning, class. Mr. Elliott's out sick this week. Turns out it was his appendix.
The students ad-lib. Cool, all right, yeah.
Your compassion is overwhelming, but I'm sure you'll be happy to hear that he gave me a list of students who will be giving their oral reports today.
The students groan.
I thought so. First up is Sarah Locke.
Sarah crosses to the podium at the head of the class, stands behind it. She reads off of a stack of index cards in front of her.
The Haddonfield Murders by Pamela Whittington. A totally gruesome depiction of serial killer Michael Myers' path of destruction in a small Illinois town.
Carrie sits up in her chair, uneasy. Of all the books. During the following, we intercut between the described flashbacks and Carrie as she struggles to maintain her composure as the memories come flooding back.
The riveting tale begins with young Myers repeatedly stabbing his older sister to death on Halloween night in 1963.
Begin flashback. During the previous dialogue, we see the correlating scene from Halloween, where Michael Myers, in his clown attire, murders his sister.
Years later, Myers escaped from Dr. Loomis's care at Smith's Grove Institution and returned home to Haddonfield.
During the previous dialogue, we once again see the correlating scene from Halloween, where Michael escapes from the outside the gates of Smith's Grove in Dr. Loomis's station wagon.
It was there that he stalked Laurie Strode, Myers' younger sister.
We see the correlating scene from Halloween, where the shape watches Laurie Strode through the screen door as she approaches the old Myers' house.
What followed was a night of terror as Michael Myers slaughtered one innocent victim after another. Strangled some, stabbed others. In the end, it was a Halloween of unprecedented carnage.
We see a montage of murders from Halloween and Halloween 2. And a flashback. Carrie, her eyes swelling, struggling to keep the lid on her emotions.
Ironically, Laurie survived that night, but was said to have died in a car accident years later, leaving behind her only daughter, Jamie.
Begin flashback. During the previous dialogue, we see footage of young Jamie from Halloween 4.
The book maintains that there's truth to the rumor that Laurie Strode is actually alive and well and living under a new identity, claiming that she gave up her daughter for adoption to protect the 8-year-old from her psychotic uncle. Bad idea. Last Halloween, Jamie's mutilated body was found in a barn just outside of Haddonfield.
We see Jamie's demise as end flashback. Focus on Carrie, unable to stand it any longer. She grabs her bag, heads to the door.
Excuse me.
Carrie darts out of the classroom. The students sit in stunned silence, baffled. Sarah collects her cards and heads back to her seat.
That was, like, so rude.
Interior, girls' restroom, minutes later. Carrie bursts through the bathroom door, locks herself inside of the empty stall, drops to her knees, barely making it over the toilet, before tossing up her breakfast.
Ta-da! I just want to say, if you need anyone to do your audiobooks, I am available.
That was beautifully and compassionately executed.
Oh, how nice of you.
And I also have to say, you handled the repeated use of correlating scene with a lot of panache.
Thank you. Shout out to my friend Samantha White for playing, what was her name? The girl. Yeah. The girl in the class. That's the scene that, like, was going to connect this 7th sequel to everything else, just like bing, bang, boom.
Except 6. They left out 6.
They didn't leave out 6. I accidentally left out 6. But the part where they kill Jamie, isn't that in 6?
Oh, you're right. Now, I have a question and a comment.
Okay, please.
The question is, in the script, is this the first time that Jamie Lee Curtis hears that Danielle Harris, her daughter, has been murdered?
I think so.
Wow. Okay, so here's my question. Like, how did she get this assumed identity and name? Like, is this a federal witness protection thing?
I think so.
Is this like a DIY?
The impression I got from the treatment is that it's witness protection.
And
although
no
it has to be,
thought,
right?
Well, and no one thought to tell her that her, like, daughter in her former life has been murdered until it's in a book?
Maybe, you know, maybe they just weren't organized. Who knows? Also, maybe she did know the daughter's dead. I don't have all of the answers for you. I just have the tone of someone that does.
I demand answers. Real answers. Based on real facts. you know, that's interesting. I appreciate that to this day, two things in movies that I wish could be outlawed is one is showing internal emotional states by having a character vomit.
It's cheating.
It is a little bit like can't you do something else? The other is, can we please, if Joe Biden gets this done, I will consider his administration totally successful if he bans from all horror movies scenes of classroom lectures or oral reports that happen to tie into the theme of the movie.
How dare you? Just because we've seen it in every movie doesn't discredit it from being awesome.
Oh my God. I love is it Halloween? 5 at Haddonfield University, where it's like, and what is the dark part inside of us? Or no, is it Halloween Resurrection?
It's gotta be Resurrection. Oh yeah, it is Resurrection.
It's Resurrection, yeah. Where it's like, the dark part inside of us, maybe the boogeyman. It's like,
so embarrassing. Yeah, I don't care. I love a heavy-handed lecture scene, and I am referring to Lynn Shay's moment in A Nightmare on Elm Street 1. Just so good. Oh, yeah, am I correct? And obviously also Halloween. Yeah, they do it in every movie, and I love it. I just rewatched Candyman for this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And they do it real good there, too.
Well, also, what kind of, like, busted school is this where you can just read a crappy true crime book for your, like, history report?
And this is, like, I'm assuming a fairly prestigious private school.
Yeah, this
place. That's how they portrayed it in the movie. And, yeah, I was thinking the same thing, like, it's like a very 5th grade book report.
Yeah, that's trash. Get that trash out of here.
Listen, the American school system needs work. It needs overhaul.
We do struggle.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yeah. So that was my very brilliant radio theater production of Halloween, The Revenge of Laurie Strode.
It was brilliant. You know, one thing we haven't spent enough time on, and I'd just like to spend a moment on it.
I love it.
It's not just Yosemite that gets repeated a lot in this movie. Uh-oh. It's also And this is something that takes us back to Halloween 4. How many times in this movie do they say it's 20 years later?
Listen, it's in the title. That gives them carte blanche.
It's the same in Halloween 4. They keep saying, those murders that happened 10 years ago. Well, it was 10 years ago. He hasn't been around here for 10 years. It's really, I love that they're like, one person in the audience might have been in the bathroom 5 minutes ago when we said this was 20 years ago. Let's say it again.
You have to say it over and over. It's Halloween H2O. I get it.
And I just want to give another shout out to two great Jamie Lee Curtis moments. When her stupid guidance counselor is having a panic attack and he's like, what do we do? She's like, try to live.
That's so good. That should have been the tagline.
Yeah. And I can't approve of that one-handed axe carry, but I really approve of her sending Josh Hartnett and Michelle Williams. Just like, you kids are useless. Get the hell out of the movie. Give people what they came for. Me and Michael Myers.
I'm always surprised that they get away at that point. I'm always like, no, it's going to be locked. No, they just go. I love that. I love
also
that
she's truck's no longer blocking it, is it?
No.
Michael's truck? It's gone, I think.
No. But in the OG script, that was like a big part, that he had blocked an entire tunnel so that he could go and kill presumably everyone at the school. It's a big undertaking. But he's had seven movies to figure it out.
Well, I like to think when this movie ends, I watched the end credits just in case, but I really wanted them to cut back to that mother and daughter stranded in the most remote rest stop ever built.
What do you mean stranded? They had a really cool muscle car left for them.
With shredded tires.
Oh.
That was like in Yellowknife or something. That was like...
yeah, it was in Yosemite. I love that scene. I don't know why I'm assuming this, that you haven't seen the most recent Halloween movie, 2018.
Oh, yeah. Which I feel like really, like, plays a riff on that scene.
Yeah, it absolutely just steals it.
Yeah.
And makes it worse. What did you think of Halloween 2018?
Oh, I really liked it.
Wow.
There were parts of it I didn't like, but overall, I liked it. And the reason I liked it is there were these great moments in it, like the cops arguing over their bon mi, or like the kid coming back from his dance lesson with his dad in the car.
That was nice.
I know. And I was like, I love the fact that these people are getting first and last names and they're not just victims and we're spending a little time with them. I was like, it felt very kind to me. One of the things I have to say is that I think that one of the horror genre's great contributions to the world is a host of absolutely awful therapists. Like, horror movies have told me anything. It's like, my wife and I will go to a marriage counselor who will seduce me and murder her, you know, or, you know, I will go to a trauma therapist who turns out to have killed my entire family. Like, therapists just suck. And if someone is interested in psychiatry as a career in a horror movie, write them off. They're trash.
Yeah, it's definitely not pro-therapy in a way that these movies should be. And I guess you've probably been thinking a lot about that lately with your new book.
I have been. And I also feel that every Halloween movie since 6 has been less for missing Dr. Loomis. There is a nonstop gif in my head of Donald Pleasence bustling up to someone screaming, no, no, and stopping them from whatever they're doing because they're doing it wrong.
He's insane. There's a part in the number 5 where he's like attacking the little girl in broad daylight.
Yes, tell me what you can see.
He's like clay all over his face. He's so terrifying. Yeah, he's the scariest part of that movie.
Earlier, when she has like the seizure and they're going to give her a stoma in her throat, he's like, no, no, you're doing it wrong.
I love him. He's crazy.
And he's played by SpongeBob SquarePants in Halloween H2O.
No.
Yeah, the voiceover, because they wanted to use a clip of him over the credits, you know, with that, like, there's evil behind those eyes.
I noticed it wasn't the same voice.
Well, but they couldn't find a clip, apparently, that didn't have score under it. So they re-recorded it with the dude who does SpongeBob SquarePants, because he's a very gifted voiceover artist.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's some trivia that I don't hate. SpongeBob in the Halloween canon. Oh, yeah, something we didn't talk about. Is that opening sequence where Marion Chambers dies?
Yeah.
Was supposed to be Loomis's daughter originally. That he had traveled to Loomis's daughter's house, which makes sense because it was Loomis's house in this one. What was her name? I had it here. Rachel Loomis.
Oh.
And apparently she was going to be slaughtered while Seinfeld was just playing in the background casually, which I think could have really been a mood.
Weird detail. Weird detail.
I love it.
The script.
I know. Although something about it does feel very Kevin Williamson to me.
Yeah. Let me ask a question, though, because I assume the nurse at the beginning of this movie was the nurse who's in the car with Donald Pleasence in Halloween 1. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. That's her. Okay. Yeah. And she's playing the same role.
Yeah.
And she looks great. Still. She looks really good. Smoking hot.
That's why I was in my head. I was like, maybe it's not her because she doesn't look old enough.
I know. But let's remember, 1998 is a long time ago.
That's true. And it is 20 years after, though. 1978.
Yeah. So that's the halfway point to now. Differences between the two that I've missed, and I don't think so. Like, I really think we've covered it all. Is there any other thoughts, lingering thoughts that you have on Halloween H2O that we need to get out?
No, I'm just, you know, I will say that I found this a really satisfying capper to Halloween, like the Halloween franchise. And I really appreciate Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, she was really insistent that there be no sequel and all this. And she committed and everything. And the end of this movie with her and Michael is really phenomenal. And, you know, you can't stop capitalism. And they literally retconned with the paramedic the day, like a day after the shoot wrapped. And the retcon to make that guy she kills at the end, thinking it's Michael, some gormless mustachioed paramedic who looks like he's in a barbershop quartet and is a really sweet dad, like, is so cruel. It's such a cruel thing to do.
It's very Alice from Friday 2.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just lousy.
Yeah, it's disrespectful.
They did dirty by Jamie Lee Curtis.
They truly did. Although, best scene in Resurrection. Like, not a bad segment, if I recall correctly.
And also, though, honestly, as far as I'm concerned, no offense to Rob Zombie, who by all accounts is a lovely human being, they could have stopped at 6 and just rebooted it in 2018, and we really wouldn't have missed a whole lot. Like, I don't think the next Halloween movie offers the world a whole lot.
Zombie movies? No.
Yeah.
No. Those are unkind, unpleasant movies. Listen, they have their fans, and I don't think that's us.
No, I don't I don't like dirty things.
No, me neither. And that's just not, like, I get making a franchise your own. I get, like, you know, you're not making the first movie, you're doing your own thing. But when you're discarding the tone of what makes the original great so blatantly, then, like, why? Just make a sequel to House of a Thousand Corpses. I'd watch that.
Yeah.
Which actually he did recently, and it wasn't good. 3 from Hell.
And, you know, listen, like you said, make the franchise your own, etc. But, like,
respect it.
They just don't do much for me.
Okay, so for the future of Halloween, we have Halloween Kills, Halloween Ends. Are you excited? Are you going to be seeing
these? You know, I am. Like, I mean, I'll probably, you know, I'll see them. I don't know if I'll rush out on opening day, but I'm excited. Like, you know, I feel like the dude's doing it now. Like, I mean, it sounds like you're not a fan of the 2018.
I'm not. Personally, I'm not. I'm not, like,
What bugs you about it? I'm really curious.
It just feels like it kind of is like everything that Halloween H2O did, but, like, not quite as well. Like, they're pretending to be dealing with trauma, but they're not doing it in a way that I find interesting or realistic. The therapist being evil, like, didn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. Why are there podcasters in it? Why are there 5 plots in this movie? It just didn't work for me. And it wasn't fun in a way that I was hoping it would be. I would watch Halloween Resurrection over that one, probably.
Ouch.
I would. But I will see the next one.
Yeah, I'll see the next 2, sure. And, you know, it's also, speaking of Halloween Resurrection, one of the best moments in that, it's not Busta Rhymes kicking Michael Myers out of an attic window. It's Busta Rhymes' speech about capitalism and how he's got to get his shit. I'm like, I want to be 18 so I can perform that as my audition monologue for Juilliard. I'll see the next 2. No problem. I'm interested in what they're going to do with it.
Me too. And also, maybe because I'm assuming they have to make them faster than the first one, if they're less, maybe if they think about it a little less hard and they sort of just go with the flow, maybe it'll be a little bit more fun.
Yeah.
So I'm into it. Listen, anytime that we get one of the legacy franchises, we get a new sequel, I'm here for it. Is Nightmare?
I know. And I definitely have to say, one of the things I appreciate about the Halloween remake is that the people doing it care about the franchise. In a way, I would perhaps say the people who did the Friday remake and the Nightmare remake maybe didn't care quite as much about.
Oh, no, definitely not. Although I do like the Friday the 13th remake. I find it.
I'm fine with it. I have no problem with it, but it's also very, it's a very disposable Friday movie.
But that's what I, personally, that's why I'm going to a Friday movie, but I hear you. I see you. I respect you. More so. Steam. Good. The Nightmare remake, though, it's a little harder to, it's a little harder to apologize for.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. So wrapping up, what is next for you? I think we know, but why don't you put it in your words?
I'm doing, Final Girl Support Group is out on July 13th. I'm doing a ton of events for it where I will be talking about murder books and movies. And if you go to GradyHendrix.com, there's an event page, which I've named Events. And as soon as I have them lined up in the next month or so, I'll be listing them there. I'm working right now on the screenplay for Horror Store as a feature film, which is being produced by the folks who did Black Swan and 1917, which I'm super psyched about. And there is nothing like writing a screenplay about one of your own books where you're like, this author is an idiot who knows nothing about writing. And then the other thing is I'm writing my book for next year right now, which I can't say a whole lot about it, but puppets. Puppets,
oh
puppets,
my God,
puppets.
Of course.
Puppets are disgusting.
But also, like, I want more puppet horror, so thank God.
Yeah, and I will say the Puppet Master movie series is not my jam. Not my jam.
So many Nazis.
Too many Nazis.
Why are there so many Nazis in those movies? As a Jew, it makes me nervous.
Yeah, did you see the most recent one?
I didn't, because it seemed extra Nazi heavy.
Yeah, it wanted to do a sort of Inglorious Bastards, Inglorious Puppet Masters. Puppet Master Bastards.
I'm into that.
Didn't quite pull it off.
Well, like, I can imagine.
If you're leaping the chasm of bad taste, you've got to make it to the other side.
Wow. Is that the first time you've ever said that?
It is.
Wow.
I thought it came off well, like I've been practicing.
It was good. It wasn't as good as my radio play, though. But it was very good.
The radio play had voice-altering technology and a score.
It did have a score, and it was royalty-free. What you gotta do?
I was hoping you'd say you composed it yourself.
Can you imagine? Of course you could, because it does have that. It did have that auteur kind of vibe.
I felt like that radio play, it was a singular vision brought to completion.
Grady, this was amazing. I don't want to take you too much time of yours, because it's been fucking an hour and 40 minutes already. Which
Ouch, your poor
I love.
Listeners.
I know. Oh, no, it's not going to be that long.
It's going to be 8 minutes long.
Yeah. I'm only going to keep the good stuff. So like 15.
I hope you only keep us saying Yosemite and 20 years later and correlated scene. That's it.
And everyone will know what we're talking about.
Exactly. I just made it.
Amazing. Okay. Thank you for coming on my little podcast. It was so nice of you.
No, thanks for having me. And when it posts and stuff, let me know, and I'll do the thing we all do to amplify each other's stuff.
I love it. Big fish, little fish syndrome.
an eternal Ouroboros of mutual self-promotion.
Yeah.
Spinning into infinity.
Exactly, because we don't know what's out there. Wow, we're getting cosmic
only
horror
darkness.
Now.
Only,
oh
only
my God, darkness. H.P. Lovecraft, you're so racist.
Like the darkness behind Michael Myers' eyes.
The darkest eyes. The
devil's eyes.
Thank you for doing this.
This was fun.
This was very fun. I will definitely send you all those links and hold you to it. All right. Well, have a great evening. Man. Bye for now. You can also follow us online on basically any social media platform at Devil Hell Pod. That's D-E-V-E-L Hell Pod. And you should like and comment and just engage with us, because we are bored. So that's it for this week. Thank you for tuning in.
Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and write a review, because it really helps us get seen in this vast, endless hell of horror movie podcasts. See ya.